Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and welcome to EIDR Radio. My pleasure to be with you. I know we have Kirk with us. We may have JB as well. I'd like to start with a few items just in the news just to ground tonight's program. One of the things that, Kirk, I have been saying for the past 20 years, that's a long time, is that we have a real problem in America with cops that are out of control. With actually having way too many policing agencies between the FBI and the CIA and the ATF, and it just goes on forever. And policing between sheriff and police, state police, local police, you name it, state troopers, highway patrol, and they're way too armed, they're way too belligerent, they're way out of control, and there is this interaction between police and judges where the judges side with the police, even though they know that they're lying through their teeth. And innocent people are constantly being convicted. You know, my view is it is better to let 99 criminals go free than it is to incarcerate one innocent man or woman. And there's a story right out of Tallahassee, Florida, that a former Florida deputy planted drugs on hundreds of drivers during drug stops, during traffic stops. So they have a routine traffic stop. They actually show his camera, the body camera, and he's planting drugs in their cars and their purses and their wallets. Planting the drugs. And then the judges believe them, the juries believe it. They convict these people. There's one guy who said, you know, because like 250 people this guy has done it. And no judge, by the way, said, you know, there's a hell of a of a pattern here in this courtroom where people who have never used drugs, have no drug record, all of a sudden are accused of having drugs in their possession. And we're sending them to prison. Not a single judge came to that conclusion. Shame on them. Send those judges to prison. Yes. All of these juries convicting these people on this policeman's testimony, send the jurors to prison. 250 people. He ruined their lives. He planted the drugs on them. You know, one guy said, you know, I was married. I had a family. I had a job. They fired me because they didn't want to hire anybody that was accused of being in possession of whatever it was that he planted on methamphetamines. I lost my wife. She left me. I lost my kids. I lost everything because this cop lied. And the judge believed him. And so did the jury. I've been saying it for 20 years. We have a problem in America, and our problem is that cops are way too belligerent. They're way too militaristic. They're way too dishonest, and they're in cahoots with the judges. I'll stand behind that story.
Yeah.
There's a story out of Egypt in a city called the Rise of Atan. And in the pictures of this city that has been unearthed, it's got serpentine walls. It's got apartments and houses for individual people. It's clear that Egypt had a caste system like the rest of the world, and the average person didn't live very well, and that the only people that had any rights were the potentates, the pharaohs in this particular case. But here is a city called the Rise of Tet that looks like it was just abandoned, as if were one day they were living in it, the next day they were not. And it dates back within hundreds of years of the Exodus. So you want to see what Egypt was like at the time of the Exodus, look at the Rise of Aten. There's a story out of Afghanistan of a woman who was talking on a cell phone. She's brought out. Of course, she's wearing her tent. And there's this creepy, disgusting Taliban dude that gave her 40 lashes. She's huddled on her knees as the crowd looks on, 8, 10, 12 people deep surrounding her, cheering on the a-hole of the Taliban, who is giving this woman 40 lashes, which is almost enough to kill her for talking on a cell phone. They are absolute, unequivocal savages. You know, Florida recently passed legislation that says that a social media company like Google with YouTube or Facebook with any of their sites that ban a politician from being able to express themselves, like Facebook did with the elected president of the United States, Donald Trump.
Yeah, I know.
That they would face daily fines up to over $250 million a day. Thank God someone has a backbone is willing to stand up to that. Listen, I disagree with everything Donald Trump said. But when you have corporations deciding who can and cannot speak, you have a really screwed up country. And of course, the people that will decide who can and cannot speak are left of Lenin and Mao. There were protests around the world with May Day. May Day is Ashura, the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God. It's been adopted by everything from socialist, secular, humanist to Muslims celebrate Ashura Day to Roman Catholics, you name it. And the protests were around the world. The biggest protests were in Turkey for Ashura Day, May Day, where hundreds of people were arrested for unauthorized protests, because in Turkey you can't say that Erdogan is a dictatorial jerk, although he is. It has finally happened after making 250 ignoramus decisions. The most recent ignoramus decision took place a couple of days ago. Biden actually made one decent decision, and that was to pull out of Afghanistan. There was a story about an amputee, four-way amputee, lost both arms and both legs. And so he says, you know, do you have any regrets? Yeah, of course I do. You know, I dropped my rucksack on an IED, and you know, I lost both arms and both legs, and should have died. And you know, my comrades, they kept me from dying. Hey, but do I recognize that we should have left Afghanistan? Yeah, there's no way to win. And so, is it sad that we sacrificed so much, we lost so much, and we accomplished nothing? Absolutely. Well, all those days wasted? Sure. And, you know, that's just the reality of it. We could stay in Afghanistan another 100 years, it'd make no difference. Yeah. In fact, the Taliban has just retaken enormous swaths of Afghanistan, even while we were in withdrawal mode. They just said, you know, America's not going to do anything. But prior to our withdrawal, they controlled more of Afghanistan than they did prior to the American invasion. Our invasion was entirely counterproductive. We accomplished nothing. In fact, we made a bad situation worse, and we sacrificed thousands of American lives and probably a million innocent civilian lives. in the pursuit of making a bad situation worse. It is one of the reasons that it is overwhelmingly stupid to be patriotic. I told you that Biden made probably his dumbest decision this week. He did. He decided that he would support the elimination of intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines. So what is the incentive for somebody to invest $1 billion of their corporate resources and apply all their corporate resources to create something disadvantageous to the world, to have their rights taken away from them, the benefit of what they did, taken away from them, and given to third world countries, the rest of the world? What is the value of rule of law if you invest based upon a certain paradigm being true, and after you've achieved success, take it away? I can tell you what happens, because it's happened in Argentina and so many other countries in the world. When you change the rules after companies have and individuals have invested and achieved, what you get is what happened in Argentina. Mm-hmm. Wheelbarrows yep. being yep. pulled up to markets to buy a loaf of bread, because nothing works anymore. Nothing is credible. All you have is belief and a bunch of liars. It is asinine. And, of course, the bleeding heart would tell you, oh, there's poor countries in the world. They can't afford to get the vaccine. And so you think that the people in these poor countries, let's take any one of the Islamic countries, who didn't contribute an iota with all of their oil money to developing a vaccine, are somehow going to, if they're given the formula for the vaccine, they're going to be able to make a plant that is capable of making a vaccine that is safe to give to people?
They can't make anything now.
No, and what's going to happen when those Nimrods make a vaccine that kills people? It's going to cause all of these conspiratorial nutcases to say, hey, the vaccine kills. What you're going to do is you'll destroy incentive to make stuff, which will destroy the economy, and you're going to give people the power to destroy stuff. And I swear, this the current president of the United States has got to have an IQ. I mean, I swear that Trump's IQ was way below normal, maybe 80 or 90. But Biden's IQ has got to be like 50 if he were to take an IQ test. This is the dumbest man. In fact, his press secretary said, we tried to avoid him being asked questions that because we know he'll embarrass himself. Black Lives Matter, by the way, came out this week and saying that they wanted Trump permanently banned from all media platforms. Of course, because Black Lives Matter is a conspiracy that has absolutely no basis in reality. In fact, speaking of disgusting, you hear that Germany had dark web websites on child pornography, which is, you know, when you're talking about the abuse of young children, that 400,000 Germans participated in. They had 400,000 clients on the dark web. I've never even been to the dark web. I wouldn't know how to find the dark web if you gave me a flashlight. You know, I'm naive in this regard. I'm naive when it comes to drugs. Naive, a lot of stuff. I'm happy to be naive in a lot of stuff. But sure. Here, there were 400,000 Germans that found this dark website and chose to become clients, contributing to a website that deliberately abused children. Do you think there's something seriously wrong with the German psyche and character?
God, you think?
You think?
Wow.
The World Health Organization come out and said, you know, we have very low confidence in the data provided by the Chinese state-owned drug maker Sinopharm on its COVID-19 vaccine regarding the risks of serious side effects. No clue. It's when do you get your first clue, Sherlock, as they would say.
Mm-hmm.
This week, French, as they say, right-wing leader, Marine Le Pen, was acquitted of breaking the hate speech laws in late 2015 when she posted images of Islamic State atrocities on Twitter. So what the hell is wrong with the French? If you post what somebody has done, how is that inappropriate? If you're saying this is bad because they're glorifying cutting off the head of one of our teachers. Right here in France, they cut off the head of a teacher. And I'm showing this because I want you to understand that there's something seriously wrong with the religion that inspired people to do this. And that's considered hate speech? All you're doing is revealing the truth. And she did it because the liberal moronic media accused her of being the same as an Islamic jihadist. And she said, oh yeah, right? So in my case, I'm using words to encourage people to think, and they're cutting off heads. And you want to say that we're equivalent? And rather than the idiot liberal periodical being brought up on charges of being stupid, they brought up Le Pen on charges of hate speech. Fortunately, she was exonerated. Well, speaking of stupid, there's a group of idiotic, women, and these must have the IQ of 20 collective. They were in a group of a cult where I guess red was the color because every one of them are dressed in red. And it was a mom cult. And so the group is called Love Has Won. They're in Moffitt, Colorado. And they, Love Had Won, their founding god, the great goddess, died. Well, the goddess being dead is not a good thing. So what they did is they mummified the goddess and propped her up on a throne and draped Christmas lights all over her. And they made a shrine to the great mom goddess. So the aficionados of this cult said that the mother god has ascended. Mom had told us all that this was coming. So she prepared all of us who feel for these mom-ments that we should look to the galaxy that took mom to the ships and shared her with us during this death mission. We thank everyone for their full surrender to the divine plan. Mom will give you the next step in your heart and every present moment that you are here. The moment tears. Mama tears are honoring.
Did they have ear hats? Wow, my God. What country are we on now?
The United States. Okay.
Oh, really?
See, Mexico's president apologized to the indigenous Mayan people for abuses committed over the past 5 centuries. Oh, it's only been 500 years. He's so sorry. Okay, the conquistadors, they came here, and they were a-holes. They gave you diseases, they destroyed you, they robbed you, they plundered you, they lied to you, they mass murdered us. And then, of course, after that, we established a government based upon the same Roman Catholic Church that came in and treated you so badly, and we created a caste system for the next 200 or 300 years. And so we're so very sorry that we treated you like crap. Mm-hmm. Speaking of crap, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, she's one of the Muslim congresswomen. She's also part of the collective group where I think the IQ of the group might be south of 50, decided that, you know what we really need is a conservation. We need to have a billion people out there fighting against global warming. So would you tell me, please, what an individual
can do
in a conservation corps, global warming corps, they call them the civilian climate corps. On-job training to work in community groups on initiatives to reduce carbon emissions. So you're going to take your average Nimrod and have them work in the community to reduce carbon emissions. What are they going to do? Say, oh, I want you to trade in your car for a bicycle. That'll be great. We want you to stop eating hamburgers because, you know, cows, they
poop a lot.
A lot of methane, yeah.
Yeah, for
we want you to, we don't want you to embrace the nuclear energy because we'd hate that. Even though that's
we drive our
carbon friendly. Let's see. We don't really like wind turbines because they kill birds. We don't like solar farms because we just don't like that kind of stuff. We really don't like anything like that. Well, we ate coal. I tell what we're going to do. Let's all burn that's carbon, too. Well, let's just all live in the dark. What the heck? We'll have the climate control.
Moral high ground.
Why don't you take us all back to the problem is that you could take us back into the time before we were burning carbon fuels. You take us back to the Dark Ages. That wasn't very good, was it?
Europe.
Roman
Empire.
As they say, stupid is as
stupid
does.
Think
it is stupid.
Wow.
The Communist Chinese Party. That, you know, the Chinese Communist Party are responsible for the millions of people who died of COVID. And their lies created. So in India right now, where there's wholesale carnage.
20 million?
People dying of COVID and getting COVID and cremations. So the Chinese Communist Party said, the image was posted that says, our idea of lighting a fire and the Indian idea of lighting a fire. And they show one of their rockets, you know, that's going to go up and put a satellite in space. And the India's idea of lighting a fire was a open cremation of the those who have died of coronavirus.
Yeah.
And they are the ones responsible for it. And they put this online as a propaganda from the Communist Party. There's something about being a communist that destroys one's morality. What a disgusting thing to do. There is a move about in Virginia to have a new educational doctrine where bias is considered part of the education, where children are told that regardless of what they might think, that they are automatically bad and slathered with the bias of racism, even though racism has never entered their thought prospect. It is a infinitesimal percentage of Caucasians that are racist. But nonetheless, the new thing is that they're racist because Caucasians in the past enslaved people. So we're part of a culture that enslaves. So you're bad, and you need to look at yourself as bad, and you need to look at those who were enslaved as good, even though they haven't been enslaved for 200 years, but nonetheless, don't look at that. Just look at the fact that you're bad. It's the new mentality. And Virginia wants to change their curriculum to accommodate that. And you know, I had a conversation with a liberal today. I happen to be a good friend. I like the guy a lot. But he's a liberal politically. And we talked about this and the fact that if you look at the history of man is the history of the castes. Every culture had one.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if it was in India or in China or in Japan or in the Americas or through the Mediterranean. The caste system was pervasive everywhere. The Romans had one. Theirs was very complicated. The Incas and the Aztecs had one. The Greeks had one. The Phoenicians had one. The Carthaginians had one. The Spartans had one. The Babylonians had one. The Assyrians had one. The Egyptians had one. They were all the same. And the purpose of the caste system was to control individual lives and to have few be able to rape and police and control the many. And God hates it with a passion. And it's just important that we know that is where we've come out of it. And today, caste systems exist in communist society. You only have the only person with any authority is the top person. He has total free will, and everybody else below him has limited free will until you get down to the lowest rungs, and the lowest rungs are nothing but pawns. In the Holy Roman Empire throughout Europe, the feudal system was a caste system. In India today, they still have a caste system. So in Islamic countries, it's a caste system. And it's very tribal, where the king is the top of the caste system. His family comes next. Islamic priests would follow that. And then ethnic participants in the same tribe and the same ethnicity would follow that. And what you find is then in places like the Sudan, where you had Muslims who were African and Arab, the Arab Muslims sought to kill the African Muslims. And, of course, the Christians were below even them. Caste systems, they exist everywhere. God despises them. And yet, if you don't understand them, you really don't understand the history of a man. There's one last item in the news. A federal judge put a hold on the ruling voiding U.S. moratorium on evicting renters. A federal judge this past week, Wednesday, throughout the U.S. Centers for Disease Control Prevention of nationwide moratorium on evictions. And what they basically said is that just because there's a virus out there doesn't give the U.S. government the right to tell landowners that they have to allow people to live in their properties rent-free.
Yeah. What if it's your pension plan?
Yeah.
And you've invested in all these buildings.
If you as the government had the money and you wanted to buy the property and then offer it to somebody free, that's your choice. But to dictate to somebody that owns that property that they have to go without any income, and they still have to pay taxes on it and pay the utilities and everything else.
Yeah.
And have to allow the people that are paying nothing to abuse their property. It is absolute, totally complete asinine. But welcome to the world as we know it today. All right. I'd like to move on to where we were when we left off last week with that review of the news and how disgusting things are around the world. This is the next statement. It says, choose to go of your own free will. This is Yahweh speaking to Moshe. Choose to go of your own free will and gather at this time the elders of the children of Israel and say to them, Yahweh, God of your fathers, God of Abraham, God of Yishak, and God of Jacob, became visible to me, saying, I have examined and taken into account on behalf of what is being done to you in Mitzrayim, the crucible of political and religious oppression. Okay, what can we deduce from that? First, Yahweh did not order Moshe to go. He asked him to go.
No.
He told him, you can go of your own free will. And that put Yahweh in a real tough spot. Because there was no one else. Yeah. I've been translating for the last week one of the most magnificent passages that you can even imagine. It's Jesse 53. It is so much more powerful and insightful than I ever anticipated. And it opens up talking about us and what we're doing. I've shared this previously. Mm-hmm. And, it says, who is it that has taken the time to validate and to correctly present our message, and who has made the identity of the Zoroa known? And, of course, the only place where that is occurring is what we're doing here.
Right.
And what I, after you're talking about this, you want to say, okay, well, God is drawing your attention to what we're saying and what we're writing because it's in your interest to know this. He wants you to know it, and he wants you to have some confidence that he is behind it. But don't think for a moment that this is a source of pride. It isn't. It's embarrassing. I mean, the only reason we're doing it is because there wasn't a single Yehudim or Israelite on the planet who was willing.
Who would.
And there weren't a whole lot of Goyim either. The choice was by default. And God has never once chosen anybody with political power, with religious influence, with academic training, anybody that you would think, wow, I can see why God chose that person. Yeah, good choice, God. No. He chooses stutterers. He chooses 80-year-old shepherds.
Yeah.
That's his style. He likes rascals, right? He chose those. Talk about a rascal. He chose Abraham, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, miserable fellow sometimes.
Okay. And why did he choose Abraham? Because there wasn't anybody else to choose. That's why. Abraham was a scallywag. It's just that he was the only scallywag willing to listen, the only scallywag willing to walk away from human, religious, and political corruption.
That's amazing. So, amazing.
Well, God had no other option but Moshe. Moshe was there. There was nobody else on the planet that could do what he wanted done. And so he asked Moshe to go, but he said, it's still your choice. Unfortunately, Moshe went. And I'm going to tell you, when you consider everything that man did, he's just extraordinary. Yahweh has three favorites. They're all Zeruah. Moshe, Dod, and Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of each of those three men are men of character that are willing to do what is necessary, no matter what it costs them personally to do. A passion for Yahweh and for his people. So it says, choose of your own free will. And gather at this time the elders of the children of Israel. Now, there would be, if you're not thinking, the propensity to think, okay, the elders would be, okay, that's the highest-ranking individuals. They didn't have any higher-ranking people. They were slaves.
No, they're all slaves. Yeah.
Okay? So there's no rank here. Forget that. So the reason he's talking about the elders is that at least they have, and by the way, to be an elder as a slave, you were probably 25 years old as opposed to 15, keeping in mind that the Pharaoh told the Egyptians to kill all of the male children. So you weren't very old to be an elder. But he said, nonetheless, I want you to go to them. There's a reason for that. There was no internet. There was no radio. There was no television. There were no cell phones. There was no smartphones. There were no megaphone. You had to pass the word. And these were the people who had the ear of more people than anybody else. Go to them. They will pass the word. The elders of the children of Israel. Every place that they are referred to in Mitzrayim, they're referred to as the children of Israel. They're never once called the children of the church. They're never once called the political and the powerful. No, it's always the children of Israel. Israel are the descendants of Jacob. That's all they are. They are the descendants of Jacob. They're the people Yahweh freed. You got a problem with that? Go complain to God. He didn't free anybody else. Ever. Second, he's interested in children. He's dad, they're kids. That's the relationship. If you want a God that is fearsome, you're not going to like Yahweh. He's dad, they're his children. And say to them, not Jebus, not Allah, not Hashem, Yahweh. God has one's name. His one and only name is Yahweh. If you don't know his name, you do not know him. Yahweh, God of your fathers, God of Abraham, God of Yishak, and God of Jacob became visible to me. What the God of Abraham, Yishak, and Jacob means is the God of the covenant and the God of Israel. Mm-hmm. He is not the God of the United States. He's not the God of Russia. He's not the God of France. He's not the God of the UK. He is not the God of the Roman Catholic Church. He is the God of the people that all of these institutions have abused. The God of Israel. He is the God of the covenant. And he says, I have examined and taken into account on your behalf what has been done to you in the dream. I have made it a policy to avoid like the plague, rendering Mitzrayim, Egypt. There was no Egypt. There is no Egypt. There was no Egypt. Even today, the people who live there call themselves Mitzrayim. Yahweh referred to the place as Mitzrayim. It is essential because matzah is about removing us from Mitzrayim. Yeast is Mitzrayim. Lowercase Mitzrayim is everything that is wrong with man. Rome was Mitzrayim. Assyria was Mitzrayim. Babylon was Mitzrayim. The United States is Mitzrayim. Islam is Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is the crucible, the cauldrons of political, religious, economic, and military oppression. It's the caste system. It's man imposing restrictions on man. Yahweh is pro-life and he is pro-choice. Mitzrayim is pro-slavery and pro-death. Mitzrayim is what happened to Europe during the 1,500 years or more that the Roman Catholics could impose their will. Mitzrayim is what happened in Babylon and Assyria. Mitzrayim is all that is wrong with man. The history of civilization is the history of Mitzrayim, of religious and political oppression, of restriction of rights, of restrictions of opportunities, of the cauldrons of persecution and cruelty, where people are confined and restricted, besieged and tested during a time of tribulation and adversity. It is ultimately based on the plural of Shur. Shur is the Hebrew word that is used to talk about the time of Jacob's troubles. Mitzrayim exists today. Yahweh removed Mitzrayim from us during Pesach and Matzah. To understand what Mitzrayim represents is the single most essential part of this story, because Yahweh Yatza withdrew us, removed us from Mitzrayim, religious and political oppression. That is the story. There's nothing more to the story than that. That is the story. Yahweh is about liberating us, removing us, withdrawing us from Mitzrayim, which is the crucibles of human religious and political oppression. So this is, choose of your own free will to gather at this time the elders of the children of Israel and say to them, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob, became visible to me, saying, I have examined and taken into account on your behalf what has been done to you in the crucibles of Mitzrayim, of religious and political oppression. And I have given my word that I will lift you up and withdraw you. Allah, es etem. By the way, the Allah here is not written as the other Allah. This is with the ain, not with the aleph. That I will lift you up and I will withdraw you from oni, persecution and oppression, affliction, frustration, suffering, harassment, poverty, being abused, being put down, subjugated, and impoverished, owning. by using Oni, Yahweh has validated our translation of Mitzrayim. I have lifted you up, I will lift you up, and I will withdraw you from Oni, persecution and oppression, in the realm of the crucibles, Mitzrayim, to the land flowing with milk and honey. Shemoth Exodus 3:17. Now, it's interesting that while Moshe was the only qualified soul on the planet with the experience, knowledge, and character to serve alongside Yahweh on this particular mission, the opportunity was presented to him as a request under the auspices of free will. Had he said no, would have been tragic for humankind. Also, without access to modern modes of communication, as we said, he would address the seasoned citizens, who would in turn speak to their relatives. The elders were chosen because they had endured the torment the longest and would be the least likely to be impulsive. This would take time, and God did not want them to grow impatient, to give up, or to take matters into their own hands. By repeating the realization that he is the God of Yisrael, the God of Abraham, Yishak, and Jacob, and thus the covenant, Yahweh is affirming these vital and enduring relationships. Many ethnicities have been and would be enslaved, and yet the only people Yahweh offered to rescue were his own. Using and repeating, but God, I have examined and taken into account. Yahweh is revealing that he has made a decision to render judgment. In this case, against the Mitzrayim, who will punish them, and he's going to punish them for having done this to his people. The recompense will be based upon a comprehensive evaluation of the evidence, all of which has been inventoried and assessed. And as you know, it got really nasty for the Mitzrayim. Now, this trip from man's hell to Yahweh's paradise is what is being told in the story of Yotam. And the reason that God said that he would lift them up and withdraw them rather than just escort them out of the country was because this whole episode serves as a metaphor for our withdrawal from planet Earth up to heaven. Everything that God speaks of in the covenant and in the Mikra are reflected in this story where Yahweh yatza his people from Mitzrayim. Now, since Amar means to say, Yahweh was giving his people his word that he would take them away from their debased existence. God's word is his bond because he never breaks a promise. And he was doing this because he had made a promise to Abraham. He told Abraham this was going to happen, but he would come to his people's rescue. He said that he's going to do it again, too. Yahweh vow really defines his role as a father. He has promised to remove his children from Oni, the thing he detests, persecution, oppression, the deprivation of rights, affliction, frustration, suffering. This not only defines what is occurring in Mitzrayim, it is a reminder that Yahweh's initial instinct is to liberate us from institutional human abuse. Keep that in mind a moment. What God is liberating us from is what his people were enduring in Mitzrayim. If you read anything that came out of the hieroglyphics on the tombs or on the temples in Mitzrayim, what you would find is that there were three things that are written about, and really only three. The Pharaoh's military conquest, the religious nature of the society and the grandeur of the existence of the state. That's all they cared about. If you study Mitzrayim and look at that, you'll see the pharaohs bragging that they were gods and that they were going to live forever. You see the priests building these lofty temples and promoting their religion. And you see military conquests. That's all you see? So what mm-hmm. is Mitzrayim? A blend of politics, religion.
Religious, military, and politics, yeah.
That's it.
Yep.
That is what got freedom from. So today, when a religious institution says, we're going to take you to God, we'll have some mammoths. They're lying through their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
God's intent is to take you away from that stuff. Just as he did take his children away from Mitzrayim. He took them away from religion and politics and militarism. And really, there's a lot of conspiracy in this story, too, where the Pharaoh said, hey, they're going to be too strong for us. We better take care of those dastardly Jews.
Yeah.
Kill the men.
Kill the Jews. Yeah.
Kill the Jews. Yeah, it's always the answer, kill the Jews. Pretty sad. So I'd mark Yahweh's words. He's going to do all of this again. Anyone who is hostile toward Jews or Israel is going to be held accountable. And they will either be killed or incarcerated forever. I don't know if you're watching the new reels out of Israel, but a Muslim that had dual citizenship, he had U.S. citizenship, he lived in the United States until quite recently, and then went back to the land of the Pakistanis. He was the one at a traffic roundabout, thought it would be just giggles and fun to go shoot and kill young Israelis. And he hospitalized several men. One very young, very handsome man he killed. And the Israelis don't take kindly to that. They wouldn't have got him. But think of it. This is an American citizen
mm-hmm.
that thought that his God wanted him to kill Jews. Pretty disgusting.
Scary.
And I watched a news story on it the other day. And they said, it's actually this evening. They said, it's the Jews are blaming the Palestinians. The Palestinians are blaming the Jews. Ah, come on. Wake up, Nimrod. The Jews wouldn't care at all about the Pakistanians. They would mean nothing to them. They wouldn't even give them a second thought if they weren't acting like terrorists, if they weren't trying to kill them, if they weren't sending them rockets and kites with Molotov cocktails to burn their towns down, if they had tunnels with jihadists and terrorists in them. If the Pakistanians would simply live in peace, if they would come to work, make a contribution.
Help them succeed.
Yeah. They in fact, the Pakistanians were the richest, freest, longest lived, best educated, most economically advanced
Muslims
in the world. In the world.
Yeah.
Before the first Intifada. But, see, that was embarrassing to Islam. So all they could come up with is, let's go kill Jews. That'll fix it. And the world wants to blame the Jews. International Criminal Court wants to hold the Jews accountable for having the audacity to respond and hunt down those that have killed their people. All based on lies. And there's absolutely no validity to a place called Palestine, a people called Palestinians, or their claims on Israel. There's none. But nonetheless, that's what the left likes to promote. And so if you say otherwise, you'll be banned from Facebook and from YouTube. Why do you look scared? Since this is the second time that Oni has been used to denounce Mitzrayim, the cauldrons of religious and political oppression, for impoverishing and harassing Israel, persecuting and oppressing Jews, it's worth noting that the pejorative that Rachel used to describe the birth of the child that took her life was Benoni. And it is from the child Benoni that the Benjamite named Shaul, Paul, came to plague the world. His religion would treat Israel similar to what they endured in Mitzrayim. Now, while we've already hinted at it, I'd like to propose a reason for the reference to, I'll take you to a land flowing with milk and honey. Mm-hmm. While there would be plenty of both in the promised land, I think milk's association is with feeding children. Yahweh desires to adopt us and to nurture us as part of his family. Now, the milk is actually his words that we might be nourished by them and grow. Now, honey is sweet, implying that paradise is going to be very pleasant. But the term has an endearing quality, which is why husbands and wives refer to themselves, each other, as honey. It's an affectionate term. Further, honey is the one food that you can put in a container and not even refrigerate. And 2,000 years after you put it in the container, it's still edible.
Still good.
I don't think there's anything else like it that can endure the test of time like that. So it's a product that endures. So the land where you can endure forever and be considered sweet as it relates to God.
Can I wait in for a second?
Sure.
Look at the word honey. And it's a B-B-chin. Mm-hmm. So you've got a doorway that leads to home, and with this, with always with, ending with words. Sweet words, endearing words, permanent words, if you think about the honey, what it actually is, because you're just saying how long it lasts, it'll always last. It's just the nectar from flowers, of course, but that's the visual. If you look at milk, it's a protective word. In the first word, the first letter, of course, is the chet, which is protection. And mm-hmm. I did a study on the top nouns and verbs that start with chet or het. And mm-hmm. it's about 97% protective words that relate to being protected. The second one is a lamb, which leads you towards home. So it's a nourishing yeah. liquid, which is a nourishing liquid, mm-hmm. cows and sheep and goats and everything, and cheese and yogurt, all that kind of stuff you can add. But it's really being protected and being led home.
Mm-hmm. I've got one more for you.
Okay.
A bee. Has the root of the DBR. Honey is even mm-hmm. based on it. Do you know a Hebrew word that is based on the three-letter root, DBR?
Dabar.
Dabar. And what does dabar mean? The word.
The word.
The milk.
Yeah.
Yeah, the
mm-hmm.
honey.
Mm-hmm.
The honey is the word of
yeah.
God.
So the
and
metaphor
it's,
is there.
It's sweet. Oh.
Yeah.
Yahweh cheats when he creates his metaphors. He does get them to walk on all four. I think it's marvelous.
That's when you invented the language.
Oh, when you invented the language, you invented the people, you invented the bee, you get to name it.
Yeah, when you universe.
You spoke in the
yeah.
world.
Yeah, you get to invent one. Yeah, so. He cheats, but it's cool because we're going to be like him, so we'll eventually be able to go out there in the universe and do the same kind of thing.
I found your description, by the way, in that same study.
Pardon?
I found your description in the same study with the
yeah.
starting with the hits. The chets.
Yeah.
You want,
yeah.
You know what? You use it later. You do a thing. I was looking for chuck 'em. Hakam or Shakam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you have a protective chet, a hand who works, engages, the
mm-hmm.
cough.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have led by the Ruach Kodesh, the M.
Mm-hmm.
And it means to be wise, skillful, to teach his wisdom. Expert, wise, skillful in the noun form, and the verbs are the same. Expert, wise, skillful, technical work, prudent and learned.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned the set-apart spirit. I've been translating, as I said, the Isaiah 53, Yeshayah 53. And everybody thinks Yeshayah 53 is all about Jesus and what he said. And Yoshe is one of the Zeruah presented in the in the testimony. But and he plays the role of the Passover lamb, and that's a really important role, no question about it. But you know that mom is listed in the 53rd chapter of Yeshaya, right in the middle of the prophecy.
Really?
Mom. Yeah, mom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it talks about mom and use the pronoun she. Now, you won't find that in any translation, but mom is there and they use the pronoun she. And it says that mom and she is responsible for taking Yahweh's soul. And she took it to Sheol. So the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Hakodah required the contribution of Yosha as the Passover lamb, the set-apart spirit who was the facilitator of these events, and Yahweh's Nefesh soul. So I wrote the longest piece I think I've ever written on what is the nature of Yahweh's soul, how did Yosha fulfill this, how did Yosha represent Yahweh, how Yahweh bequeathed his soul for a limited period of time to Yosha, and how you make the transition from Pesach to Matzah with the same soul, but the body of Yosha is gone. But now you take Yahweh's soul and take it into Sheol, and it is really Yahweh who experiences Bakurim with the set-apart spirit retrieving Yahweh's soul from the black hole of Sheol. And so the reason that the disciples and the mother and everyone else didn't recognize Yosha was Yahweh. And it's really interesting that transition, and where Yahweh uses the word nefesh soul twice to describe the transition and the discussion. But there is a mom sighting. She is there and plays a significant role.
When does that come out? And hot off the press?
No. Yes, I think this is now the second chapter on Matzah. So there's two chapters. We're reading the second of the two chapters that are the prelogue to Passover. So that's where we are now. We're I think page 11 now of the second of two chapters that are the prelogue to Pesach. Then there's two long chapters on Pesach, both of which I finished. And then there's a very long chapter presenting Matzah. And it's really interesting. So much more to Matzah than I had anticipated. I'm so glad that Leah shamed me into doing this. And basically, she said, I wouldn't give what you've written in the past to any one of my Jewish friends. Now, keep in mind, Leah's like so many of those that are in the covenant. It's not a single person that has become part of the covenant based upon what she has shared with them. We kind of all have our things. That's not a knock, because if you look at Yeshayah, Isaiah, there's not a single person who came into the covenant because they're Yeshayah, and he is the most magnificent of the prophets. So, but nonetheless, that is her thing. And Jesus said, I wouldn't give it to anybody. That was kind of hurtful. But our relationship began with her being hurtful and said, how dare you as a goy translate my people's Torah. So that's how we started. So, but the fact of the matter is, I even got a lovely card from her today saying, I'm really glad that you did this. And so am I, because she was right. I wouldn't, now that I've had a chance to read what I wrote, I wouldn't want to give what I had written anybody either. It wasn't very good, really, compared to what we can do today. It's
Got us on the road.
Yeah, it did. Got us on the road. Got us pointed in the right direction, But oh my goodness,
this is a gift that keeps on giving, though. I mean, this
Keep on working for it, and,
right.
And wouldn't it be terrible if you reach the point of that's the ultimate. That's all you can know.
That's good. What next?
There would be nothing next. So, you know, thank goodness we're continuing to learn. And thank goodness we've got the humility to say, well, that wasn't as good as it should have been. But I'm so glad she's pushed me in this direction. And, yeah, it's a lot of work still to do to get through it all before we move on to new material. But it's really, really good, I will tell you. It's so much better than what previously existed. So anyway, I'm delighted that that's where we are. So I've completed the first probably 160 pages or so, maybe 170 pages on matzah, and I've got another about 40 pages to go on matzah, and then we'll be in Bukurim. And by the time we finish Bukurim, we'll be done with volume 4 of Yada Yahwa. Volume 5 of Yada Yahwa will take the next 4 Mikra. And go through them. I think it's good. Volume 3 is called Mikra, and Volume 4 is called Moed. So that's where we are in the editing process, the rewriting process. And well, what we're reading right now is fruit of that. And they will listen to the sound of your voice. Then you and the elders of the children of Israel will go to the Moloch, the king of the crucibles of oppression. And you will say to him, Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, the Ibrahim, has scheduled a meeting with us. This is Kara al-Ananu. He has summoned us to an appointment at a specific moment in time, expecting to meet with us. It's Kara is from Kara, to invite, to summon, to meet, to greet. It's in the Nifl Perfect, which means that God is the instigator of this encounter and anticipates being influenced by it. So now, therefore, we implore you to please. Isn't that so nice? Please, not.
Yeah.
Allow us to walk away. Allow us to walk away on a 3-day path into the wilderness to ponder the word. Bamidbar. Me, to ponder the who, what, where, and why of Dabar, the word. We will prepare a meal to approach Yahweh our God. This is not the first hint of Passover, because this is not speaking of Passover. This is speaking of matzah. Because they didn't prepare the meal to approach Yahweh after they had walked away. Matzah is what they experienced after they had walked away.
Mm-hmm.
Pesach is what they experienced while they were still there. And one of the things that we learn as we go through the first 3 mikra is that all mikra are not created equal. Matzah is infinitely more important than Pesach.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even close.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, Pesach is actually referred to as Chag Matzah.
Yes.
Eternal life for a spiritual being, a spiritual being like Yahweh, where light is eternal, to bequeath eternal life is a very small matter. Very big to us, but very small for him. To perfect the likes of me, that takes some doing. And to do so honorably and justifiably and appropriately, to yank the Mitzrayim out of rascals like me that grew up in religion and politics, that identified with religion and politics, that lied on behalf of religion and politics, and to withdraw the Mitzrayim from us, now that takes some doing. And so he's talking about Mitzrayim. This is a really, really powerful passage. One of the things that I quickly learned, whether it be in Yatzeya or in the Torah here in Shemot Exodus, is whoever the idiot was that broke these statements into verses, out of state on his horse, and just
the old priest in front
rode into the sunset. First, it doesn't know when to start and stop something, and second, there's so much in this one statement that to incorporate all of this is, I guess there was a time when we had the focus to do that, but this isn't that time. I mean, we've been so dumbed down with sound bites in the media and, you know, flashy things. We'd be dazzled with the Kardashians for crying out loud. It's really tough for us to go through a message that has this much
that many words,
teaching and guidance in it. And so, you know what I find out I have to do? I do the translation. I have to set the translation on another Word document so that I can go through it and write the commentary on it, because the beginning of the translation is like two pages from the commentary I'm writing on. I have to make a separate Word document just to work through it.
Yeah.
And you've got to do it that way because there's just so much to this. So God's saying, they will listen. So what was the prerequisite of God freeing his people from being impoverished and being persecuted and being abused, being deprived of life and liberty by the Mitzvah? What's the prerequisite?
You mean they're walking away?
Then no, they will listen.
You got to hear the
words. You got to listen.
You got to hear the words.
They will listen.
Yeah, of course.
If they don't listen, he can't do a thing for them.
God says
they will listen. Simple statement, but Moshe spoke for Yahweh, and he says, they will listen to the sound of your voice. What's interesting here, he didn't say they will listen to the sound of my voice. They'll listen to the sound of your voice. Why? Because Yahweh chose to speak through Moshe. Would he have spoken directly for himself? Yes. But no. And I've talked about this before. Could Yahweh have performed all of his signs and wonders in front of Pharaoh and talked to Pharaoh on his own, and it just be God be Pharaoh? And your inclination, of course, is, of course he could. He's God. He can do anything he wants. No.
No, he can't
because
do it.
He's God, he can't do everything he wants. You and I can do whatever we want because we're scallywags. God's not. He's got character. He can't do anything he wants.
I know. I'm just laughing at us.
Yeah, but it's true. God created the universe because he wanted to enjoy having a family. And so when God wants to accomplish something on behalf of his family, he has to engage with a family member. It's as simple as that. The idea of God operating independently destroys the entire purpose the universe he created. So God actually could not go to Mitzrayim to free his people, because if he did, he would have destroyed the entire concept of creation and the covenant. So he's telling Moshe, they will listen to the sound of your voice because I'm speaking through you. Now, we ought to put that in perspective. You know, I've said I am.
That's very exciting.
Like,
don't you think?
For me, I'm embarrassed to the max because, you know, I know me better than you all know me, and I know that God should have been able to do a whole lot better, and yet I look at the result of what we are learning here and say, wow, this is really good. This is profound. Nobody has come up with these things, these insights, and conveyed them in 2,700 years. This is pretty neat stuff. And you realize, Okay, but nobody else wanted the job.
Yeah.
Nobody else was even remotely interested in the job. And by the way, to take this job, you're considered to be an idiot. No one's going to like you. I mean, Dee, for example, Sweet Dee, because she has the Shamar Torah site. She will tell Leah, she says, you can't imagine the amount of abuse that Craig gets. He says, I mean, they just call him every name in the book. There's so many people just go after him to demean it. It's not a fun position. You get a lot of grief. And so we all ought to want to translate and share Yahweh's testimony in a meaningful way. It's a job fraught with all sorts of issues. Here, Moshe did it, and it was tough. But it's how God works, and he says, "Okay, so you're a stutterer. You're 80 years old. Yeah, they want to kill you because you killed an Egyptian. I don't care. You go in there." They're going to listen to you. And that's exactly what I find today, is that, okay, you know, there's a lot of Jews that are religious. They're not going to listen. There are a lot of Jews who are really political. They're not going to listen to me. There are a lot of goyim that are political and religious, conspiratorial. They're not going to listen to me. But there are an exceedingly meaningful number who will listen.
Mm-hmm.
And God didn't say they're all going to listen, they're all going to respond, but they're going to listen. That's enough.
Mm-hmm.
If so long as you know that there are some that are going to listen, what we're doing is worth the effort.
Carry on.
Yeah,
right.
Carry on. Mm-hmm. They're going to listen. Then you and the elders of the children of Yisrael will go to the king of the crucibles of oppression, and you will say to them, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, not the God of the Roman Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
not the God of the Muslims, not the God for America, the God of the Hebrews. Yeah, by the way, Abram, you know what it means? The opposite side. Oh, the
yeah.
opposite side. Yeah.
Okay.
From the region beyond. That means
mm-hmm.
there's you and them. And it's
mm-hmm.
true today.
Fair enough. Yeah.
There's you and them. They're the chosen people. They're the children of Yisrael. They're God's people, his family. There's them, and there's the opposite side. What's the opposite side? Goyim. So the Hebrews, the Abraham means the opposite side, has scheduled a meeting with us. Kara. Yeah, he has. Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shabuah, Teruah, Kippurim, Sukkah, scheduled a meeting with us. This one is speaking of Matzah. It's an appointment, a specific moment in time to meet with us. So you want to kill us. You want to work us to death. He wants to be with us. You're a crappy king.
Host.
He's
mm-hmm.
God of the universe. The God of the Hebrews. He's summoned us to a meeting. So now, therefore, we implore you, please, just allow us to walk away on a three-day path. I have... one of my favorite people has come to the conclusion that Bukurim is not always the third day. Bukurim over 3 days in a row,
mm-hmm.
and has promoted the idea that it falls on the Shabbat, the day after the Shabbat following Matzah, so that if matzah was a Shabbat, it would be the first day of the week. If matzah was not a Shabbat, it would be the day after the first Shabbat after Matzah. I don't concur.
Now, people who have that
this
theory.
Person is really, really smart. He is a wonderful fact checker. Love the guy to death. And it's just like you, JB. You and I have a different interpretation of the timing of Pesach. And I like it when there's an intelligent, thoughtful disagreement. And I still hold the position, my position, though I respect yours. In this particular case, I respect his assessment. And I said, I'm not going to determine whether or not I'm going to agree with your assessment or continue to advance what I've come to conclude until I've done all of the translations on Matzah and Bekorim. And I've now done almost all of them on Matzah, not Bekorim. And this is the first of about 10 overwhelmingly, in my view, strong statements that says it's Pesach, Matzah, Makorah, 3 days in a row, regardless of what day it is. God uses the verbal form of Shabbat, which is even stronger than Shabbaton, to describe Matzah. It says you're going to observe it as if it were a Sabbath. He brings out every gun he's got. It's Kodesh. It's Estem, essential. It's celebrated like it's a Shabbat. He goes on and on. Every label that he can supply to say this is the single most important day on your calendar, he ascribes to Matzah, including calling it not only a mikra, not only a moed, but also that it is the chag matzah, which includes Pesach. So I am of the conclusion still that it's 3 days in a row, and this is the first of those clues. I'm going to take you on a three-day journey. Now, is it possible that the three-day journey was such that Pesach was started on a Thursday night, went through through Friday, that Matzah was the started Friday evening of the Shabbat, and the first Matzah with the children of the Yatzah, and that therefore Bekorim would have been the following day, because just like the year that Yosha was the Pesach Al, the Pesach Lamb, it was a Thursday evening that he ate Pesach with his disciples. He became the Pesach lamb on the end of that day and concluded, fulfilled it before sundown, so that on the Shabbat, a natural Shabbat also of Matzah, that he was able, Yahweh's soul was able to fulfill Matzah, and such that the first day of the week, we have firstborn children. Yes, that happened on a natural Shabbat. So it's possible that 3 days is here because God was going to arrange this similar. So it isn't proof in and of itself. And by the way, should my friend be right, it really doesn't change anything in terms of the way we celebrate those days. You may choose to celebrate Bekorim on a different day, but it's
still celebrating Bekorim,
right? Yeah, yeah, and you're celebrating Bekorim as the result of Pesach and Matzah. So no matter when you're celebrating is the result of Pesach and Matzah, and we're going to agree on that fact. As it turns out, we agree on everything that's important, and we spar occasionally on details where there is varied interpretation. This is a detail, but nonetheless, it is one of those where I'm going to say, not emphatically, that having done this study, I am my tendency is to support Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, three successive days. This is one of those insights that would lead us into to that conclusion on a three-day path. And this says, Ha-Midbar. Now, I have come to recognize, and I think I would be surprised if there was anybody that is studying and translating Torah that would disagree with this at this point, that of the many, many hundreds of Hebrew words that either have ma or mi in them, and they precede a common Hebrew word, in this case, mi and dabar. Yeah, mi, my, in Hebrew is not just an interrogatory. It's an interrogatory about a individual. It tries to identify, can you ascribe the individual who is responsible for what follows?
Yes.
So any one of these, you know, mishpat, for example, mikra, for example, that have the ma or the me, they're asking us to ponder the implications of the word that follows. And in this particular case, we're dealing with the implications of the word.
Yeah.
So we're going to go, we can say into the wilderness, but we're going to go ponder the words. We're going to ask the who, what, why, where, and when questions, but mostly because me is a personal interrogatory, we're going to ponder the source of the word. When you render it like that, all of a sudden something that just would be just passing where you wouldn't give it a second thought. Okay, I'm going out to the desert. Why would he say that? What would be the purpose of saying that? But if he's saying, we're going to, over the course of a three-day path, we're going to study the word, now you know what you should do during those 3 days, right?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, it goes from a meaningless statement, we're going to go out in the desert, oh boy, whoopee, to
a very specific
the purpose of what we ought to be doing on Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim is delve into the source of the word and ponder who offered it to us. We will prepare a meal to approach Yahweh. Every one of these is La, Yahweh. La means to approach, to come near. Can it be translated as a gazillion other things? Yes. Concerning, too, as a result of. But its primary meaning is to approach. This meal that we're going to prepare, Zabak, we're going to butcher a sacrificial animal and eat it to approach Yahweh. Well, that also tells us that even though the Pesach lamb, whatever isn't eaten, is incinerated at the end of Pesach, that since he's talking about matzah here, but he's talking about chag matzah, which includes also Pesach, ain't nothing wrong with eating lamb the next night.
Hmm.
I do. I just happen to. But you know, we've found out from Hezekiah that
just party all day long.
Pesach and matzah for a long period of time is okay with God. So who would have thought that God would have said please? Clearly, he didn't need to do so, but it does set a good example, doesn't it?
Oh yes.
It would have cost Egypt nothing to let God's people go free. Slavery is always the wrong approach, politically, economically, morally. The cost of hiring somebody and paying them enough to feed themselves and their family and have housing under an economic system that does not usurp people's freedom is actually less expensive than trying to control a slave where you still have to feed them and you still have to shelter them. But you also now have to have some kind of military or policing effect that keeps them from running away. And so the cost of that is unfavorable for slavery. Moreover, it's unfavorable from a morality point of view. To do that to another human being destroys the perpetrator's character. Always a bad choice. But it cost the Egyptians nothing. What were you going to say, Kurt?
I was going to say that to make your point, a lot of people don't know the history of the post-Civil War. They didn't have any money. The Yankees didn't give any money to the Southerners. And they didn't have any way to build the railroads back, and they still had all the cotton growing. So they couldn't get it to market. So they had to build railroads. That was primary number one. And what they found out was, with no slave labor, they went to the Chinese and paid, you know, $1 a day or whatever it was. And by God, they built all the railroads back, and they actually write about, this is so cheap. Why do we have slaves?
No, we have chance. Right.
We don't have to feed them. We don't have to house them. We hire them and need them, and they go away.
Right.
So, to your point, I just, as I was reading this.
In every possible way, slavery is a bankrupt system. Of course, people like to control other people. So it would have cost Egypt nothing to let God's people go free. Ultimately, oppressed people revolt against their overlords and eventually they prevail. Often taking the government down with them. The cost to acquire, house, feed, train, manage, guard, slaves, in addition to keeping them healthy, exceeds the overall cost of paying people a reasonable wage. Moreover, any time a nation turns a blind eye to the suffering of others, or worse, is responsible for persecuting people and becomes parasitic, it decays and dies from within. It is the history of civilizations that had never, or I guess I should say in the history of civilizations, it had never occurred. God chose to meet with one nation to remove them from another. Only time this has ever occurred. Prior to encountering Moshe on Torah, Yahweh had met with individuals. He had met with Adam, he had met with Chawa, he had met with Cain and Abel. He had met with Noah and his family. But an entire ethnicity, an entire nation, never. And especially relevant, the word Yahweh used to acknowledge his upcoming encounter with Moshe, Kara, which is based on Kara, serves as the basis for his Mikra invitations to be called out and meet. With Kara scribed in the perfect conjugation, which means it's limited to a specific and finite duration of time in the past or future. If it were not for the context, it would have been appropriate to render it in the past tense. However, since a group meeting had not yet occurred and the feasts, Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim were still ahead of them, I think it's more appropriate to translate Kara el Anakdu as has scheduled a meeting with us.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
And that works.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
As has been precisely, this whole thing has been precisely worded to convey what I think is a vital message. Their journey from Goshen to Mount Chorob would be around 250 miles. Now, that's too far to walk in 3 days. A total of 90 miles is about as far as they could have been expected to traverse in that time. Average person can walk about 30 miles a day. If everyone was reasonably fit, if they had plenty of food and water, if all went well, they would arrive in Arabia back at Mount Chorob in a week. Although considering the participants and the terrain, that's pretty optimistic. Therefore, the reference to attending a meeting with Yahweh and to a path which would require 3 days clearly speaks of the first three Mikra. The way to God and to the promised land begins with Pesach, continues through Matzah, and concludes with Purim, which order in succession over the course of 3 days. Each of these occur in 3 days. Now, that's my conclusion as to what he has said. I know that there are others that view that it could be 3 days, but could be a different length of time. And I'm willing to admit that God, he's pretty clever.
That's a little bit.
And he could have arranged his calendar so that this particular year, just like in year 4,000 Yah, that Pesach fell on what we would call a Thursday night, and therefore Matzah occurred on a natural Shabbat, such that Purim was the following day. And then it would have been over 3 days, just as it was over 3 days with Yosha in 33 CE. But there's no indication that God wants Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim to be celebrated over a longer period of time than that, recognizing that Chag Matzah is a seven-day affair by itself. Therefore, the references, I think, is to Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, not to reaching Torah. It would have been impossible for them to have traversed 250 miles in 3 days. So this represents the same 3 days that Yosha, Yahweh, and the set-apart spirit worked on our behalf, really, to fulfill Passover on yeasted bread and firstborn children, beginning on a Thursday evening, April 2nd, through the Shabbat of the 4th, and concluding on the first day of the week, which is April 5th in 33 CE, on the Julian calendar. It's really a challenge here because you got three calendars here. There's Yahweh's calendar, the 14th, 15th, and I think the 16th day of the month of Abib. And that's pretty straightforward. But people want, because we don't have a published calendar that is Yahweh's calendar, folks want, well, can you calibrate that on my calendar? Well, we're currently using the Gregorian, which is a Roman Catholic construct. It is based on all things, like all things Roman Catholic. All things Roman Catholic are based upon Imperial Rome. The Gregorian calendar is based upon the Julian calendar. It fudged a few days because the Julian calendar was 365 days. The Gregorian calendar is 365 and a quarter days. And they had to keep their precious Easter close to Pesach. Because it was migrating away from it, because they didn't have the leap year accounted for in the solar year, and so by the time we get to the Gregorian, we have different days of the week for the fulfillment than we have on the Julian calendar. The Julian calendar was in effect at the time, so it probably makes the most sense to set these dates based upon the Julian calendar. But if you wanted to reference them in today's calendar apparatus, we're using the Gregorian. So sometimes I just put both down so that you have both, but the fact of the matter is this happened April 2nd, April 4th, and April 5th in 33 CE on the Julian calendar. And that is why there is a reference. And by the way, I was once very frustrated as to how difficult these dates are to set, because of the fact we have a Gregorian calendar and a Julian calendar, and yet these dates occurred on the Julian calendar, and what we're using is the Gregorian, and there are a number of days different. And so it was, oh man, this is really makes it hard to establish these days of the week and days of the month because of this, and it keeps you from being emphatic. But this is what I will say emphatically, is that Pesach was celebrated on the 14th day of Aviv in year 4000 Yah. And on the 15th day of Aviv, Matzah was celebrated in year 4000 Yah. I think that that was occurred in 33 CE. The Daniel prophecy points to that time, and as does everything else, including the accounts of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim occurring on a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, but finalizing on a Sunday morning, the first day of the week. Everything fits in 33 CE and does not fit in the 3 or 4 years before, the 3 or 4 years after. And when you go back in time and look at the laying of the cornerstone for the temple. Now, my friend says it's actually the date of the calling of Dode. And I don't, whether it's the calling or the date of when Yahweh first said, he is my my chosen one. He is, I am anointing him Messiah, or it's the cornerstone of the temple. Historically, we know that the temple was, the cornerstone was set in 968 BCE, and since there's no year zero in either the Julian or Gregorian calendars, that would put us exactly 1,000 years or 20 yobel to 33 CE. And when you do the history, you go right back to Abraham and Yitzhak and Mount Moriah.
And
1968 BCE, and you get to Adam and Chawa exiting the Garden of Eden in 68 BCE. So the timeline all
but you know the Exodus has to. The Exodus has to be on a 50, on a Yobel year, too.
It's
just highly unlikely, don't you think?
I don't know if the Exodus has to be on a Yobel year, because...
Really?
No, because that wasn't the... No, it's not the intent.
No, I understand.
The intent
that,
of the Mikra is to be fulfilled.
So sweet if it were.
Actually not. No, actually not.
Okay.
It's a misunderstanding of the purpose of the event. The first four Moed Mikre are fulfilled in year 4000 Yah. First four Moed Mikre are fulfilled in the year 4000 Yah. The last two are fulfilled in the year 6000 Yah. Dode becomes the centerpiece of our existence on Yah's relationship with humankind in year 3000 Yah. In year 0 Yah is when Adam and Chawa are expelled from the garden. Year 2000 Yah is when the covenant is affirmed, and we are given the opportunity to go back into the garden by what occurred between Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yah on Mount Moriah. These essential events took place not only on Yobel years, but in increments of 40 Yobel, which is 2,000 years. The timing of the Exodus is 40 plus 400. That the children of Israel were free in Mizraim for 40 years. For 400 years, they were slaves. It is the very day to which they had been enslaved for 400 years that the Yatzah, which we render now as Exodus, it means the Yatzah, that means to remove, to release, to free. The Yatzah took place 400 years to the day that they were enslaved in Israel and Mizraim. So the timing of the Yatzah Exodus is based upon establishing increments of 40, 400 years in this case, as being the period of a time of testing. So it establishes that as the time, and so its timing is based strictly on establishing 40 and 400 as periods that we ought to look at, and that's why there's 40 Yobel between these seminal events and in human history and Yah's interaction with his people. So it didn't need to take place in the Yovel year.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, at the time of the Yatza, of the great release and removal, there wasn't even a reason for a Yovel. Because the Yovel is Yahweh's strategy as it relates to when Yisrael would enter the land. What he wanted was that every 50 years, all slaves to be free. Yeah, he wanted all debts to be forgiven, and he wanted the land to be returned. It was a brilliant strategy. Total free enterprise, knowing that we're not all equal in terms of
capable,
our ability.
Yeah.
And so it gives people 50 years. That means by the time you're productive at that day, you know, between 15 and 20 years, you've got until the time you are 65 or 70 to be productive. And if your productive period is like, 20 to 30 of those years, it gives you the chance of even to be productive and pass on what you have worked for to your children, which is a wonderful concept. But it does not give your children the ability to live on a gift that was given by someone else and to build these long dynasties. It doesn't give the ability to have plantations of where you have the lords and the serfs. It doesn't give the ability to control people through loans and establish banks that control people's lives. It doesn't give you the opportunity to have slaves. Because every 50 years, you've got a complete reset. So it's a perfect system. And so the Yovel was designed in the land to establish that. So time is demarked in the Yovels. Is it possible that that the Exodus took place in a Yovel year, I suppose? But was it one of these Yovels in terms of 20 Yovels or 40 Yovels? No, because it was right around 1450 BCE.
What I think is really sweet in the sense of getting even, Yahweh lets the Amalekites run Egypt for 400 years. You can trace them all, well, actually 440 years, because when they didn't take the land of Israel and they're in the desert, the Amalekites take over that area and control most of everybody that's in Israel now. Of course, they put El Arish as their big armament place, and then they have another one in Syria. So they can control the pathway of everybody coming. So because they didn't take it, they have to deal with these Amalekite jerks for another 40 years because they've already gotten a stranglehold in Israel. So, but it's really sweet. I mean, they put you for 400 years, and okay, you like that? I'm going to show you how to – I'm going to let these people take you over.
Yeah,
and that's easy enough to prove. Yeah,
so yeah. You thought that having slaves.
You don't want to go in. Okay.
Why don't you become their slaves?
Yeah,
tell me what you think
about
it.
Yeah,
exactly. 40 years.
And they did.
Yes. So it's a the teaching.
It's just killing off the sons. Yeah, it's just.
Yeah, is the emphasis on 40s.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the. That is why there was a reference to the preparation of a sacrificial lamb in accordance with Yahweh. The blood of a lamb would be and now has been spared on the upright pillars of the doorway of individual Israelite homes during the evening before they would leave Egypt. And while we have the benefit of hindsight and can now see how the whole picture fits together from beginning to end, Moshe, at least at this point, didn't understand the role Passover, unyeasted bread, or firstborn children would play in his redemption or in ours. The Torah hadn't been revealed to him at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He had not experienced, he hadn't even heard of Passover. So as such, he would have had no way to appreciate the majesty of what had just been revealed. That's the way God likes to communicate. You know, I told you that how profoundly different these translations and insights have been than what was written 10 to 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And That's largely because Yahweh's story, while straightforward and consistent and brilliant, is not written to be easily understood. One of the things Yahweh said when he talked to Moshe, he says, the difference with what I said to Moshe versus any other prophet is I just laid it all out very simply with Moshe. There are no riddles, no enigmas, nothing to figure out, just straightforward and simple. But with everybody else, I spoke in a way that required you to think about what I was saying, to really contemplate the meanings of all of these things. And I think that's largely why you can work on translating and interpreting Yahweh's words for 20 years and look at what you did the ninth time that you did it and say, oh, boy, how did I miss all this?
I missed that. Okay. Well, that was an admirable effort, but it failed.
Yeah, and that's the
and
that's
failed,
thrill
but
of,
you
but that's
you
the
missed
thrill
some,
of
you
it. That's the reason stuff. Why, yeah. JB, you found that you couldn't translate without sharing the insights.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the insights that are thrilling. When you figure out, oh, wow, this is what he's talking about, and this is what it means, and these are the implications. The insights are so exciting that we can't wait to share them, and that is the advantage of having it being a voyage of discovery, which every time we go through it.
I've even found that as I write, like, commentary, I'm revising my I've got my kind of working method is I'll translate the entire passage, make a few notes here and there. Then I go back and write the commentary piece by piece. But as I'm doing that, I start noticing little things like, oh, no, this doesn't quite work. Let's see. And then by the time I'm done, the translation's completely different.
I spent all day today going back over Yeshaya 53:10, leading to 53:11. I had written it. I was all done with it yesterday. I spent all day going back into it today because it dawned on me there was a change of voice. The whole prophecy had been written, and Yeshaya's voice, all of a sudden now, it transitions into Yahweh's voice. It had been written up to this point where him was speaking of Yosha, and then it transitions where him is speaking of Yahweh. And then him isn't speaking of either of those two, it's speaking of Dod, and Yahweh is speaking to us in first person. And understand who is speaking and who they mean by we and our or his and him is the key to understanding of the past. I went and spent all day today having a ball. It was so much fun. God, I couldn't even. One time I was called to leave my chair, and I wanted to lash out and say, how dare you? But it was an example of, I had written it. I was so pleased with what I'd come up with yesterday. I was so excited, and I was going to move on. I was going to finish Yeshaya 12. Today, and that sounds like, okay, well, big deal. That's one lousy verse, idiot. And I never even got to Yeshaya 12. Because I went back and said, wait a minute, there's a real interesting story here as to who is him and who is we? And why did we change from lowercase him to uppercase him in the middle of this? And who is what doing what to who? It's just amazing. Well, one of the things I came up with as I was doing this is that when you study Yeshaya 53, what becomes immediately obvious is that the way that Yahweh provided the Passover lamb, which is what he promised to do, is that Yosha's soul was Yahweh's. And that the soul that the set-apart spirit, Mom, who and it's a direct relation to a direct citation, says Mom, that took to Sheol is Yahweh's soul. And so the transition is him, lowercase, to him, uppercase, and the prophecy actually mentions soul twice in the midst of that transition from him, the Passover lamb, to him, the soul of Yahweh. And so when I did that, I said, okay, I better explain what the difference is between Yahweh's soul and our soul. And it was just really marvelous to explain this, because while our soul is the sole repository of our personality, our aptitudes, mm-hmm. our attitudes, it's our life force. Our soul goes, we're gone. But with Yahweh, as a spiritual being, there is no physical body to animate through the soul. The soul is an adjunct to Yahweh. To use the line of my least favorite movie of all time, Yahweh's nefesh is an avatar. It's a probe. And I use the example of Perseverance, the most recent of the Mars rovers. Perseverance, as a probe, gave humankind the ability to go to a place that would be deadly, Mars, that we couldn't survive, that gave us the ability to hear what was happening there, to see what was happening there, to experience all that was happening in that place, projecting our senses into that place as a probe, as an extension of ourselves, so we could experience it while we're not actually there. Yahweh's nefesh soul is that kind of a probe, far more sophisticated, of course. It is how Yahweh was actually able to experience, to observe, to feel, to see, to experience Sheol. And so it's extremely enlightening to have an appreciation of how Yahweh honored his promise to Abraham to provide the Passover lamb by loaning his nefesh soul to this individual named Yahweh Saves to perform the role of the Passover lamb. He's now gone. The body is gone to take his soul now, and he himself paid the price of matzah, no greater love. And to have the set-apart spirit be the means to get his soul in and out of the black hole. And then he says, you know, once he had endured it, he was introduced again to the light, taken out of that darkness and then back into the light. And as you then go through it, it's just all the pieces fall together, and Yahweh has explained in Yashaya 53 exactly how he enabled matzah bakurim, matzah, Pesach matzah and bakurim. And he actually concludes it by saying, the result of bakurim is my firstborn. Who is Yahweh's firstborn?
Dode.
It concludes with Dode. He is my Sadak, my servant, my Abed. It's through him that we come to understand and we're vindicated. And that's the reason why the whole prophecy begins by saying, who understands this, that writes it such that we can verify it and affirm it in a way that is understandable? And who is it that knows the Zeruah? Because if you don't know the Zeruah, you don't know what he's talking about.
No.
It's going to be one of the thrills of this program, even kind of hinting at it. I went back and I rewrote what I had written previously on, this is JB, to your experience. I was really pleased with what I'd come up with in terms of Daniel 9. Went back and rewrote the whole thing. It's much more profound than what I had thought. So we'll go through that as well, as to what God was actually predicting. And it wasn't the arrival of his Messiah. He was telling us the history of the final two beasts and what those final two beasts would do to his place and his people. So all of these are one of the things that I enjoyed so much in as a child, I've enjoyed it as an adult, where you are given a puzzle and it has all those 1,000 pieces and they all have different shapes and different colors and different patterns. And you have the great joy of being able to fit the pieces and patterns together to create a complete picture. Yeah, his words are a lot like that. He's given it to us that way for a lot of reasons. One is that there's, if a puzzle came all together, what fun would it be? If we were given every answer, where would the joy be of learning? How would God have a litmus test, an ability to filter out who was going to enjoy eternity with him and who would be a pain during it? And what would keep life exciting if we didn't have a thirst for learning and for discovery? And can you imagine the Nimrods out there that if you gave them, here's the five things you got to do. Do these five things, and you get to live forever.
Hear it.
How many idiots would say, all right, I'll do those five things, not understand a net about who Yahweh is, what he endured, to make it possible, nor care, nor by the way, number one means you really have to distance yourself from Mitzrayim.
Yeah, that cuts a big swath of them away. Don't it?
No conspiratorialists, no people who are passionate about their politics, nobody who's patriotic,
no flag waving.
Religious. Yeah, you've gotten rid of 99.99% of the world right there. you already start, this idea called by
Yah
to do something. Yeah, you're already start with the fact that, 999,999 people disqualify themselves. So you're already starting with, you got to be one in a million for Yah to even be able to approach you. And at that point, there's just not a lot of options for God. He is exceedingly unpopular. Sometimes we think we're unpopular. We don't have much to offer, and we're unpopular, but he is really unpopular. And he's cool, man. He is so enlightening and fun and charming and lovable, intelligent. Yasaya 53 says, essentially, it's based upon what he knows. If you can think your way to this result, and you think your way through this result by recognizing how special Dode is in my life and how special Dode is in the fulfillment of Bokoto. And of course, I had so many years thought that Yosha was the epitome of Bokodom because he was the firstborn child. But no, he's not the son of God. And he didn't even exist at that point. So Bokodom is celebrating Yahweh's firstborn. And Yahweh tells us who his firstborn is. He says, Dode is my firstborn. Well, this prophecy is emphasizing that. Dode's his firstborn. And God's telling you, okay, I endured matzah, I endured Pesach, and now I'm going to celebrate, and I'm going to celebrate with my firstborn son. The reason I did all of this was for Dode. If you want to join us, great. But I did this for Dode. He's my kid. He's my guy. It's just marvelous. Well, Asher has fallen sound asleep. Leah is about ready to fall asleep. My voice is about ready to give out.
My dog's asleep too. Paint.
You're talking. Paint is asleep. You're lucky you're not hearing Asher snore, because even though I mention her name, she's not even winking. She really thinks the world of this show. She is very, very impressed with her doggy dad. Yeah, if I want just a dose of humility, look at Asher. Of course, also for a little humble pie last week. I'm so excited I thought we just had a marvelous show. I was just so invigorated by it. So I walk out of my office to see how much Leah enjoyed it, and she is absolutely down for the count. Completely and totally asleep. Leia had
well, make a lot of noise before
you
go in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. Leia had had 4 years dressed up on the Shabbat. And she always viewed that I'm dressing up, you know, I've got mom coming for dinner, our spiritual mother, and I'm going to, you know, Yisrael is Yahweh's bride. Out of respect, I'm going to dress up for Yah. Always clean the house, prepared a lovely meal, had flowers on the table, and put on one of her prettiest outfits. It was just an endearing part of the beginning of Shabbat. Always enjoyed it. So we were, I was translating something about a week ago, and she was talking about the Queen of Shabbat, because as I was translating this, and you're dealing with matzah twice or three times, matzah is emphasized by the work of the malacca. When the malacca is our spiritual counselor. She is our spiritual mother, the malacca. And she says, well, of course, you know, malacca is the queen of the Shabbat. And I said, well, can you give me a, where in the Torah and prophets it says the malacca is the queen of the Shabbat? She says, oh, but, you know, I was raised, the malacca is the queen of the Shabbat. I said, well, you know, before I write that into this book, I'd really like to read where it's.
But I say, yeah.
Yeah, but I really like. I don't think I can quote you know, Laura Leah chapter 1:3. I really need to know where it says that.
And
guess what she found out? That
what?
It is a huge part of rabbinic lore. The Queen of Shabbat is the wife of any Orthodox Jew. And she gives the blessing for the family. And she is, this whole big deal is made out of her. She puts in her finest outfit. She cooks her finest meal. She blesses every member of the family. And she found out the Queen of Shabbat is Asher in rabbinic Judaism.
Well, that's, I was going to say, the minute you said queen, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, it's the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God. The rabbis, of course, screwed it all up. And
yeah,
they have their Queen of Shabbat is
Asher.
And so she said, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I said, no, don't let them ruin it for you. You are Yisrael. You're the bride of Yahweh. It's lovely to make the Shabbat special, to dress up for Yahweh. It's such an endearing and beautiful thing. To recognize the love affair between Yisrael and Yahweh. You know, I'm a disgusting goyim. Fortunately, God likes some goyim too, and I'm here with my flaps and my jogging shorts and an old worn out shirt. And you know, but that's appropriate for us goyim. But she's Yisrael, and it should be a special thing like this. And for me, the Shabbat is a time of reflection in Yahweh's word. I love to spend it studying. And so here's just a wonderful example of how Yahweh has a marvelous message about the malacca. And what was interesting here is if you look at every translation, malacca is just ordinary work. So, you know, it's got Obadah or one of the typical Hebrew words for work, followed by malacca. And so they make it servile work or ordinary work or that sort of thing. If it was really work, it'd be work. Don't do any work. But malacca doesn't mean work. Malacca is the feminine of malak, which is a spiritual messenger.
Spiritual.
And heavenly envoy, God's implement. It's just the feminine of malacca. And so come to find out that the rabbis know this. So the way they came up with the Queen of the Shabbat is that malacca is used in every presentation of the Shabbat. When it says don't do something, it's don't do the work of the Malacca. She's really important. Capitalize on what she's doing. Enjoy what she's doing. Just don't try to do it yourself. So they actually call the Queen of the of Shabbat Hamalaka Shabbat. They know the Malacca is the feminine manifestation of Yahweh. They call it Hamalaka Shabbat. And that's the Queen of Shabbat. So it's not that these idiots are stupid. It's just they're evil. Isn't that amazing? So we found the Queen of Shabbat already. And in doing it, we verified that they know what I've found out, that Malacca is the maternal counselor, it's the set apart spirit, our spiritual mother, the Malacca. They figured it out.
No place to hide.
They corrupted her, of course, to the Queen of Heaven, because what's a religion without a little Asherah? Anyway, that's my personal story. Our personal stories are okay too, you know. It is how we it's how we learn. It's how we understand why religion is bad, and relationship is good. So I'll leave you with Hamalaka Shabbat. And by the way, that's not so
Hamalaka
bad.
Shabbat.
If you translate it correctly, she is the spiritual counselor of the Shabbat. She is the power behind it, the love in the midst of it, the one that conveys all of the warmth and light of Yahweh, the maternal manifestation of God's nature. So Hamalaka Shabbat is a marvelous thing, properly understood. Okay, fellas, it's been a wonderful way to spend the Shabbat. Total of pleasure. Asher is beginning to snore, so I don't embarrass myself. I'll say Hamalaka Shabbat. Good night.
Good night, Shalom.
Good night, Shalom.
Good night.
Asher, that is so embarrassing.